Welcome to episode 2 of the Anarchist Book Club with Jim Yeoman and me, Danny Evans, a podcast in which we chat about a book one of us has recently read. In the near future, we hope to include interviews that will allow you to hear different voices, but for the time being, the format remains that of me and Jim talking to one another. For this episode, we've tried to improve the audio, but there's still the odd glitch. The patient listener is implored to bear with us. This episode discusses Dominicio Lasurdo's War and Revolution, translated by Gregory Elliott, published by Verso. We hope you enjoy it. Okay, so what's the book all about?
So yeah, the book is a part historiography, part sort of history of ideas from kind of Burke to Nolte and Pipes, these kind of revisionist historiography lineage, and I would say part polemic really as well. I think it's doing all of those things kind of at once. And I actually came into reading this book not knowing that that's how it was going to be. Perhaps I hadn't done my research on the book necessarily, but I was surprised that the kind of historiography, history of ideas was a constant sort of style running through. So the main point really, it is a critique of revisionist history, particularly revisionism, which seeks to, in the author's words, liquidate the revolutionary tradition, to critique and kind of cast out of the history of the West, in inverted commas, and Europe, the notion of revolutionary thought as being illegitimate. And this is traced really as a starting point, Edmund Burke, the British Whig critic of the French Revolution, up to contemporary historians such as Ferguson. I would say the main sort of charge that's made against revisionism is that revisionism is hypocrisy, and it's hypocritical, and it's one-eyed, and all of the charges that are made about the revolutionary tradition can equally be applied to the non-revolutionary, or to the Western tradition, or to the colonial tradition, that there is nothing substantial to the revisionist critique kind of laid on all revolutionaries from Jacobins to the Bolsheviks that can't be done to the US, the UK. They're the main targets, really, because that's where most of the scholars that he talks about are based and work on.
So it's a repudiation of a revolutionary tradition that associates the French Jacobin revolutionary tradition with the Bolshevik Revolution in some way. How does this revisionism deal with its own revolutions, if you like, you know, the English Civil War and American Revolution?
Basically, by casting them as a separate phenomenon. Earlier on, you know, some scholars are still including the French Revolution in a positive light and actually separating that out from the Bolshevik tradition, particularly we see it around World War One. French statesmen, British and American statesmen would positively discuss the French Revolution and separate it from kind of bad revolution. But by the time of the Cold War, this link that you talked about is being made, this, you know, kind of bundling together of these two great revolutions. What then that requires, as Lasurdo would put it, a sort of repression of the realities of, for example, the American Revolution. That's one that he dwells on a lot, and to say that this was fundamentally different, either because it was about liberty rather than what is dubbed fanaticism, because it wasn't as violent, in their words, because it promoted respect for property. You know, it depends really on what the particular author he's critiquing views as being the positive traditions of the West. That's all placed on the American Revolution, particularly. There's not too much discussion of the English Revolution of the mid-17th century. There is some discussion of the Glorious Revolution in the later 17th century, but again, that's kind of cast in a similar way to the US Revolution. It's basically a kind of peaceable change of government rather than these totalizing social revolutions of France and Russia.
So is Lasurdo's point then to kind of point out, in contrast to the revisionist position, that in fact the West does have its own revolutionary tradition that could also be accused of fanaticism and extreme violence?
Yeah, certainly. You know, one of his main points is that if we're interested in the history of revolutions as historians, not as polemicists or as ideologues, you know, using revolutionary history as a weapon to attack people in the present. One of the sort of main points is then, if you're tracing these dynamics backwards, why is 1789 the starting point of the revolutionary cycle? Or why is that only as far back as you go in the search for the roots of genocidal violence or extreme ideological fanaticism? Why is France, you know, seen as this starting point? It completely removes histories of colonialism, of slavery, of the revolutionary experience in America, you know, the revolutionary repression which followed the American War of Independence. It's a total deliberate kind of forgetting of the violence that has always been a part of European American history. I think one point that he makes, which is very astute, is in America and the UK, we're looking at two states which went through revolutions and two world wars and the Cold War, and they're really the only ones that haven't been found on the wrong side of history. You know, they've not been kind of held up to the scrutiny of somewhere like Russia or France. And so really this kind of revisionism is a one-eyed history of the victors of history. And in doing so, it completely obliterates their own extremely violent histories.
What's the purpose of establishing this, the comparability of these different revolutionary traditions and their you know, their moments of fanaticism and violence? And is it just to establish a kind of moral equivalence between the English Revolution, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and the Russian Revolution?
Well, I think that's a good question, because, you know, one of my main sort of thoughts throughout reading the book was what is the ultimate point of this? You know, aside from a intellectual exploration, which, you know, I do find interesting, but at the same time, perhaps slightly unforgiving reading of this would be that it's whataboutery, that it's just trying to collapse distinctions and create comparisons across revolutions and bring in other events into the same categories of analysis, then say, well, they're all bad. And I can perhaps deduce a purpose from that, but it isn't always particularly clear, I would say, in the book about why it is this is being done. I don't think he follows up on it enough to say, well, we have this comparison and here now is what we're going to do with it, to say something about revolution or to say something about history in general. A more generous reading would say the intellectual climate in which he's critiquing did very clearly distinguish France, Russia, Marxism, anti-colonialism, basically on one side, and other histories, better, more acceptable histories on another. And that it's not just whataboutery, it's actually the dissolving of this kind of ideologically imposed barrier between the two says something not only about the past, but about the world that we live in today. And I think there are lots of relevances of this book, of this argument, which is quite densely academic and probably not massively accessible, but they haven't quite been kind of extrapolated and translated enough into what is the value of this critique. Do you think it was whataboutery?
Well, I read the last chapter, which is titled The Black Book of Communism. So named after this like Cold War era attempt to tot up all of the dreadful things that have happened in the name of communism to arrive at some really high figure of deaths of people as a result of like the communist experiment. And I thought, okay, so maybe this is where he deals with the importance of the October Revolution and where it stands in relation to this other revolutionary tradition. And so I skipped to that chapter, and it's not about that at all. It's not really about the Russian Revolution. It's not about communism. The majority of the chapter is just dedicated to delineating the appalling crimes that have been committed not by communism and the colonial roots of fascism, all of which is perfectly legitimate, but basically seems to evade the issue of where does the Russian Revolution sit within this like litany of terror? How do you account for it? And yeah, it did. To be honest, it did seem like whataboutery to me. Not that I don't think you couldn't draw like interesting or persuasive conclusions from establishing the essential comparability of these different revolutionary moments, but I assume that they wouldn't be the same as Lesotho's. Or what I imagine he's intending. But since I haven't read all of the book, is there anywhere where he addresses the issue of counter-revolution? How does the idea of counter-revolution fit in with his overall like perspective on revolutions? Because
It seemed to me in the parts that I have read that he's kind of stretching out the revolutionary moment to include all of its consequences in a way. He says to understand the Glorious Revolution in 1688, you need to go back and understand the English Civil Wars as a part of a process that finds some kind of endpoint there, or even doesn't, finds its endpoint later on in the Reform Acts or what have you. And then the same with the American Revolution, you should extend it up to including the Civil Wars. But then seems to do basically the same thing with Russia as well, where like there is no need to account for the extermination of the vast majority of the old Bolsheviks in the establishment of Stalinism. In fact, I don't think there's a mention of Stalinism as a separate phenomenon. It's collapsed into the Russian Revolution as a singular process.
I'd agree with a lot of that. The collapsing of Stalinism and October 1917, it's very apparent throughout, and lots of times, I did want him to talk about communism, to talk about revolution. And you asked about counter-revolution, but I don't think he really gets into why these revolutions happened, or like what the purpose of them was, or how the transformative events were. The section that you're talking about with the kind of very long list of infamies of the West, when I said that, this is part polemic, I think that's one of the examples of it. I think it's actually one of the better examples of it in the book. I was imagining reading it as someone that hadn't read the whole rest of the book, where he takes most of those incidents that he lists there, from the genocide of Native Americans to slavery, Ireland, India, this huge litany of kind of disgraceful, disgusting colonial practices, and then compares them to what Stalin said, which was talking about the freedom of all peoples of men, these kind of very egalitarian, you'd agree with them, these statements. And he says, I'm not doing this in order to show that Stalin was good and this colonial tradition is bad. But what I'm doing is I'm taking the argument that's made against communism, which is to look at all of its terrible things that were done in its name and compare them with what liberals said they were doing, which is a really fatuous way of doing things. What Lasuda is saying is, well, we should compare like for like. And in his words, in a sense, like for like is comparing the crimes of Stalin to the crimes of the British Empire, not to what J.S. Mill says in On Liberty, which I think is fair enough. I think that's quite a powerful section. And I imagine reading it, you're only going to read one chapter of this book, I'd probably recommend you read chapter 7, because I think it contains all of those arguments in one powerful polemic. However, through the rest of the book, I was wondering, where is the discussion of communism here? If you're doing, as is said explicitly at the start, that this is a comparative history, and the only way that we can understand these events is through comparison, it's not really comparison. It's putting the critique of revisionists of revolution on one side and using it to critique Western colonial liberal traditions on the other, and giving that side far more attention. And again, for his purposes, that probably suits, because I don't think he is interested really in a comparison. The only elements where he really gets into discussing Stalinism, there is a section on the Ukrainian famine and the massacres of the Polish officers after the division of Poland in 1939. Now, again, fair enough, he brings those in and talks about them. He gives them, in a sense, he gives them adjectives. He says that they're terrible, that they are, a stain on the history of communism. In fact, I'm going to take that back, because no, he doesn't. Unlike what he does on the other side, is that he tacitly, or even explicitly in some places, tends to explain away violence committed by Jacobins and the Bolsheviks. He explains it away. He offers routes out that aren't permitted in his analysis of others. Perhaps his response would be to say, well, that's what the critics of revolution do, but I wonder where this gets you. And it ties in to his wider analytical point about there being two different ways in which basically mass murder can occur, when it's talking about two different ways in which people are dehumanized, or in Lasuda's words, despecified. He says that there is a socio-moral way of doing it, which is what revolutionaries do, and there is a naturalistic, ethnic, racial one, which is what, in his words, the West has been doing for centuries. Now, I think there's an interesting point in that. However, even in his own words, totally collapse in on one another at various points, but he doesn't really explore that. For example, in the case of Soviet post-revolutionary Soviet Russia, or the terror of the French Revolution, they aren't they aren't delved into about not only that those categories started to break down precisely at the moments where you see the extreme violence and repression, which to me that would have been something to get into. Why is it that it's these junctures where these categories kind of fall in on one another? But actually I think it's used as an escape route, and he actually says that this socio-moral way of dehumanizing, these are in his words, there is a way out of that, and that's why it is morally more acceptable. If you're a class enemy, you can no longer belong to the bourgeoisie if you so choose. If you're a kulak, you can not be a kulak, but you can't not be a Jew. And that is a way of, I think, never explicitly, but almost touching on the idea that, well, it's slightly less bad. And I think that, in a sense, I don't want to argue with that, because I think I wonder if it's a really constructive way of looking at things.
But you would at least need to look at how it played out in practice. And if you were going to seriously discuss the Russian situation, then you would obviously need to account for things like the massive anti-Semitic campaign conducted in the 50s under Stalin, the so-called doctor's plot. You would need to think about, you know, forced deportations of national minorities, including communists. I mean, where's the get out there, you know, for ethnic minorities in the Soviet Union being forced from their homes, including including communists, like members of the Communist Party. So I don't think it holds up in practice. But even if there weren't those examples, you would still need to think about whether or not those so-called politico-social categories were really applied. Were they really applied in such a way that gave individuals an opportunity to change their ways? Or were they applied in a completely arbitrary and blanket fashion? Obviously isn't the case when you consider that relatives of Trotskyists were sent to the gulags just for being relatives of Trotsky, not because of anything that they themselves had actually done. So I don't think that argument really holds any water.
No, and there were several points at which I was, you know, explicitly writing, that's not true. You know, it is claimed that Bolshevik justice was targeted on the individual and had an element of responsibility attached to it. And I thought that isn't true. As you say, families were targeted, villages are targeted. And the same for the terror. And he makes the same claim for Robespierre and the terror. People identified by the Committee for Public Safety, not only them, but their whole families would be guillotined. At points, he'll say, well, but there were some slippages. But again, it gets explained away. You know, there are points at which he levels the same critique. The example I'm thinking of is on Robespierre as doing this, as collapsing these categories. But that is explained by saying that the revolution had started to turn back to pre-revolutionary ideas. So he says, although we can see these extremely problematic features of these revolutions, when we see them, they're not revolutionary, they're pre-revolutionary. So only what he's terming as acceptable violence is revolutionary violence, and which isn't, becomes pre-revolution. And so famine in Ukraine is lamentable, but ultimately a mistake. Repression of political enemies, which in the USSR is not discussed at all whatsoever, is ignored. The terror is explained away by saying, well, everyone was just as bad. I find it quite disappointing in that way. Inability or unwillingness to treat like for like, for something that presents itself as being premised on comparison. And the point of comparison, I think, to go back to an earlier question, you know, I totally agree that this comparative eye is needed, and to treat the French Revolution, as François Fourier does, for example, one of his main targets, as a kind of isolated instance of fanaticism and madness, that's fine. But, you know, I don't think it's a case of being, if you are posing critical questions of these junctures, then you belong in this ultra reactionary revisionist kind of mindset. So it's possible to be critical of particular revolutions, or even the whole revolutionary tradition, if you want to look at things that way, without being Carl Schmitt.
There's like a moral dimension to criticisms of all of these revolutions, because all of these revolutions probably unavoidably involve appalling violence and repression. But I suppose there's an alternative, the normal orthodox Marxist historiographical tradition would separate out those revolutions by saying, okay, well, the violence associated with the English revolutions, the American revolutions, and the French revolutions are not just violences against the ancien regime, you know, against the old society. They're also violence that creates conditions for capitalism to become the dominant mode of society in those territories. And then the Russian Revolution will be distinguished from that, because it's supposedly of a qualitatively different nature. It's supposedly a socialist revolution. What I was thinking when I was reading it was this, you know, Amadeo Bordiga, one of the founders of the Italian Communist Party, who's like was criticized by Lenin in Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder. He, in later life, came to the conclusion that the Russian Revolution had to be, you know, ultimately considered a bourgeois revolution, that it's a capitalist revolution that establishes the conditions for industrial capitalism in Russia in the same way that, say, the French Revolution had done in France. And so, you know, your moral revulsion and objection to the what happened in the Russian Revolution could then easily kind of map onto a similar kind of disgust at the violence at those other revolutions, because they would, they're ultimately comparable on that basis. But I think in order for Lacerda to really kind of broach that kind of argument himself, and I do think in some ways, superficially, this, what I've read of the book doesn't seem to clash with that kind of interpretation, potentially maps onto it. You would still need to have some kind of understanding of counter-revolution, particularly in the Soviet case, you know, and he just doesn't seem to want to broach that. I mean, what do you think about that? Like, do you think he sort of sees a kind of qualitative similarity between these different revolutionary processes? I mean, he seems to suggest at one point that they're all effectively moments in a democratic revolution.
Yes and no, because I think, you know, he critiques revisionists for separating the revolutionary tradition from the non-revolutionary tradition. I think where he ends up is maintaining that distinction because he does view France and Russia as being more important, as being better, as being worthwhile. You know, there's a point towards the end of the final chapter when he brings in Rousseau's quote that I would rather kind of renounce liberty for the entire world to spill a drop of blood. And, you know, it's a very Rousseauian thing to say. And it's also, you know, clearly it's not going to hold up under scrutiny or under kind of historical analysis. But he steps back from making the point explicit. So I don't want to put words in his mouth, but by bringing that in, and Kant as well, to a point, you know, the kind of moral absolute of Kant, and showing how limited they are. You wonder where that goes then. So he's not advocating or justifying mass murder, but you could claim that in some of what he's saying, is that there are certain moments which do require it. And that's an argument to be had, but he doesn't really have that argument about why it is that these moments are different, why it is that, for example, the US Civil War, which he invokes, you know, throughout the book, which I think is a very interesting moment to write into this history. He kind of poses the question to the reader, you know, who would question that the violence, you know, the intense violence and military occupation by the North of the South was worthwhile for the emancipation of slaves? Very few people would argue that now. And so, you know, this is where the value, I think, of bringing in these events in together. But it sidesteps the Jacobin violence and Bolshevik violence, the counter-revolutionary violence enacted by these regimes. And there's a section on the metaphor of Saturn devouring his children, coming from a quote from Hannah Arendt, you know, that this is the inevitable consequence of all revolutions. And his conclusion to this point, to say that, you know, all revolutions end up kind of devouring their offspring, is yes, but we should also include the American and British Revolution in that. And I don't think, to me, that's not a satisfactory sort of exploration of that. He doesn't think about why that happens, you know, or the effects of that happening on the revolutionary tradition, for example. Why it is Bolshevik leaders looked to the Jacobins, not just for their ideology, but also to their methods. There are concrete connections between these things that go beyond the idealism of emancipation.
I've seen that quote attributed to Danton, who was obviously executed by Robespierre and the Committee for Public Safety.
It could be Arendt quoting Danton.
There's a problem of, on the one hand, the revolution eats its children. I suppose, like, he doesn't mean that in a literal sense in the case of the American Revolution, I suppose. Like, the Civil War then is a kind of the slaveholding children of the American Revolution are then devoured by the democratizing, egalitarian aspects of the American Revolution through the victory of the North in the Civil War. So that kind of makes sense. And I think, you know, there is a logic to that argument. But I think it's, you know, what happens in Russia, in the Soviet Union, is of a completely different order, because it's not just that the children of the revolution are devoured. I think in many ways, the children of the revolution are devoured as the final stage of a consummating stage of a process of counter-revolution in which the initial aspect of the revolution, which is internationalist, which is radically democratic through the, you know, the power of the workers' councils, the Soviets, is completely eliminated, completely smashed. And I think really to have that just elided just ends up, when I was reading this, just thinking, okay, well, this person's got a completely different understanding and perspective of that whole situation to me, which is obviously a fair enough thing. Lots of people disagree with me. That's a fact I have to live with. But I do think it makes some of his like arguments and explanations incredibly specious. Partly, like we referred to that earlier when we were talking about the naturalization of the enemies of the Soviet regime to go into to way beyond something that you could just reduce to political or class enemies. But in some ways, it's the very fact that the meaning of the Bolshevik, or not even the Bolshevik, the meaning of the October Revolution, which is really about workers' control, Soviet power and internationalism, the meaning of that had to be completely vacated for Stalinism to exist and operate in the way it did. And if you take an example like Spain, which you're both familiar with, how Stalinism operated in as a counter-revolutionary force within the Spanish Civil War, and you can't trace that back in any serious way to the October Revolution. In fact, it was the very vacuity of Stalinism is what made it such a powerful and malleable and adaptable counter-revolutionary agent in that situation. And in fact, is what allowed it to be adopted in Catalonia by the traditional spokespeople of the Catalan middling classes. And the racist or racializing discourse against southern Spanish migrant workers who were often attracted to anarchism. That racializing discourse was able to be subsumed entirely into the dominant Stalinist discourse at the time. You know, they were able to just map onto one another the idea of the anarchists as a lump and as a kind of alien agent within the more wholesome kind of socialist realist proletariat was in many ways just a Soviet, more accurately Stalinist translation of nationalist Catalanist tropes from the previous 30 years or so. I mean, obviously, La Sorda is not going to account for episodes like that either. But once you do accept that a counter-revolution has taken place in Russia, it opens it up to a different kind of understanding of those kind of moments. And you don't have to, like, perform somersaults to try and understand, you know, or to try and excuse a mapping of naturalizing, targeting of an enemy with the politico-social targeting of enemy. You can see it as a consequence of a counter-revolutionary process.
I'd agree, you know, to your point, really, that what this is exposing is that the Surdo and you and I think very differently, not only about the Russian example, but, you know, about what revolutions are and why they happen. And there is no sense in the book that Russia has undergone a counter-revolution. And that ties in with two points, not uncommon in this type of writing, sanctification of Lenin. So therefore, I think he finds it basically impossible to countenance the counter-revolutionary violence of the early Russian Revolution. And whilst there is an acknowledgement of failures of Stalinism, of the crimes of Stalinism to an extent, the critique is only really extended to Stalin's methods rather than his politics or, you know, the ambitions that Stalinism he is taken as given that Stalinism belongs in the same tradition as October 1917, and the two are used interchangeably, whereas you don't need to be a revisionist to say there is substantial difference between what's going on in 1917 and what's going on in 1928, in 1936, in 1949. And this unwillingness, really, to grapple with that hangs over his analysis throughout. I agree that this is a real absence. When he says, well, what revisionists do about revolutions, to shine a positive light on, say, the US independence, they will highlight a very small part of it and say, this was the American Revolution. Whereas with France, you know, it can be backdated and forward dated into the 19th century. And with Russia, it's all of the crimes of Russia are in this long durée. And he seems to suggest that long kind of conceptualization of revolutions is preferable to looking at those moments. But I would argue that thinking about revolutions does require us to think about those specific junctures and moments when, for example, as you brought up 1917, you know, when work and control was possible, when big revolutionary change, as we see it, becomes alive and becomes possible. These junctures where new ideas fly and the world changes, for me, those are the revolutionary moments. And Stalinism, I find it extremely difficult to write that into that lineage, just because essentially Stalin said so, seems to be Lozardo's point. He said that it belonged to that tradition. He creates this absurdist kind of polemical point about this and says, I'm doing this to expose the fallacy of liberal arguments which compare bad communism practice with liberal ideology. I'm doing this kind of absurdist thing, you know, no one would ever kind of praise Stalin. But he basically is. He never actually does critique Stalin in any sort of serious way beyond giving a tempered criticism of the Ukrainian famine and the Katyn massacre in Poland, which he talks about and does say that it's, you know, one of the worst crimes of the Soviet Union. But caveated with a kind of brief allusion that Beria may have misunderstood a note given to him by Stalin. And then that's just ended there, that maybe they didn't mean to slaughter all of these Polish officers.
He provides like a pretty compelling criticism of your traditional, what you might call liberal or Western apologists, showing how the ideals of supposed liberalism didn't match up to its own practice. And using things like colonialism, slavery, genocide, to establish the point. But in a way, is he not like conceding some basic grounds of the revisionist argument, suggesting that reality never matches up to the ideals? So therefore, just as the reality of the United States doesn't match up to the ideals of the founding fathers, the reality of the Soviet Union doesn't match up to the ideals of Lenin or even what Stalin says on paper. You know, the reality is messier. Ultimately, where does that lead you? How does that viewpoint really distinguish from a liberal one? I mean, ultimately, it seems like the trajectory is like just an anti-utopian kind of fatalist argument, whereby all these kinds of crimes were appalling, regrettable, and yet we might like state this in a kind of polemical fashion if we want to like take down, you know, revisionist historians like Niall Ferguson or whatever. But you know, by his own logic, these kinds of events are broadly understandable consequences of the overall democratic revolutionary tradition, you know, for better or worse. But where that leaves any kind of like socialism, where that leaves any kind of project for genuine emancipation, for experimentation, I think is just, it's obviously sidelined in his worldview. And I even read somewhere an interview with him, or like an extract from an interview with him, where he said that, you know, Marx's idea that the state would wither away under communism was a really, it's a kind of tragic idea that had disastrous consequences in Russia, which I think is a really bizarre point of view, particularly when, like, you know, part of his whole point is like separating out theory and intention from practice and reality. But it's obviously also like completely untrue. That idea that, like, you know, Marx's notion that the state would wither away under communism did not have disastrous consequences in Russia. I mean, how would you actually establish that? I suppose what he's trying to say is that, you know, on some level anyway, is that the moment of revolutionary possibility in Russia, however long you say that lasts for, that's the kind of chaotic, damaging, anarchic, if you like, period to what we would actually consider to be the Russian Revolution, the revolutionary process, the revolutionary possibilities. That's regrettable. That's the disaster. But the appalling, mass-murdering nightmare of industrial authoritarianism that is established in its aftermath, that's, you know, what we need to rescue for historical posterity.
I think that's a very fair critique. I mean, you know, what do you want from revolution? What do you want from these moments? Do you want Stalinism? Well, then, yeah, 1917 is lamentable, and people trying to do different things and abolish the state and set up worker power probably is. But that seems like an odd objective to have. It reminds me of an argument that was put to me, which claimed that the communist PCE in Spain were not counter-revolutionary. They were conducting their own revolution, which resulted in centralization, mass national army, even extended police powers, and that this should be counted as a revolution. Now, that argument can be made if you're saying that revolution, that's where they all end up. But it does leave you thinking, kind of beyond an academic sense, into more, you know, what we think and believe about the world, is if that's what you want, then it's not, that doesn't fit what I see as being revolutionary.
Or socialist.
Or socialist in any reasonable sense. It's taken understanding of socialism or communism as being that which existed in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, which, again, I'm not sure many people would subscribe to. In fact, you know, it's a favorite refrain of lots of people, you know, is that we want communism, but we don't want Stalinism. Well, in a way, this is saying, well, we do.
It does seem like there's a bit of a resurgence in this kind of thinking. Perhaps the publication of this book is a reflection of that. I mean, this is published by Verso, which emerged out of New Left Books. You know, broadly speaking, at least in its beginnings, a Trotskyist lean in kind of publishing operation. And now it's publishing books which could be read as an apologia for Stalinism, or certainly by somebody who's a Stalinist, not in a even intended necessarily in a pejorative sense. If you're going to say anybody's a Stalinist, I would imagine that Lesueva would count as one. So what do we make of that? I mean, it just seemed like there's a trend, not necessarily massive, perhaps bigger in the United States than here, of going back to this, associating the Soviet Union with really existing socialism, like a practicable, realistic approach to socialism. Something qualitatively different to capitalism, and also as a kind of morally superior system to colonialism or imperialism.
I think it's a very worrying trend, this, as you say, a revivalism of that disgraceful part of history. You see, it's a kind of facetious example, but you see kind of memes and things constructed with Stalin saying, like, off to the gulag. I don't know, rich people tweeting on Twitter. I thought, well, I can kind of see the sort of polemical value of that, but I kind of think it's disgraceful. And, like, not just from a kind of taking some superior position as regards saying nasty things, but I just think it's a really odd and problematic kind of way of seeing anything, seeing history, seeing the history of the Soviet Union, seeing the lives of millions of people, seeing the crushing of revolutionary possibilities. Again, it goes back to, in a sense, of what I said, that, you know, you don't need to be Carl Schmitt to criticize the Russian Revolution. I think it's almost falling into that dichotomy that a very long tradition in lots of countries has sought to extrapolate from the history of socialism, from the history of revolutions, from the history of liberation and emancipation. Lesueva himself denounced Khrushchev's secret letter. Most of his works are not recent. You know, this stuff was being published in the Cold War and in the 1990s in particular. That kind of almost Stalinist revivalism wasn't there, as far as I'm aware. That current, you know, the socialist left would run a mile from that kind of interpretation of it, you know, very much influenced by post-1956 new left histories and to distinguish the Marxist tradition from the USSR.
Perhaps in the UK there's something, you know, and perhaps the US as well, the collapse of Trotskyism, effectively of organised Trotskyism in the last, like, 10 to 20 years, which reached its most acute crisis point with the coming to light of sexual abuse in the British Socialist Works Party, has exposed the lack of any strong alternative socialist currents, I suppose. If something like Stalinism can worm itself back into something approaching academic respectability, points to a bit of a failing on the part of like a broader heterodox or libertarian milieu, maybe. Or maybe we're also, you know, there's also like the kind of intellectual laziness and wannabe edginess of like hard left publishers. I mean, I like you, I didn't know who Lucerda was when I bought the book, and I just took it for granted, like seeing an Italian name, oh, this will be like an Enzo Traverso style heterodox post-trot type, I'll probably like this. And it didn't turn out that way at all. And like, in terms of like why it's worth reading this kind of stuff, I mean, if this is the best, like this is the most intellectually rigorous that neo-Stalinism has to offer, that, you know, the Soviet Union was about the same as the British Empire, then I mean, it's not really worrying from an intellectual point of view. It is somewhat worrying if people like who really are invested in trying to change the world feel like this is their best bet or like their most hopeful or inspiring route.
Yeah, it's a pretty low bar, isn't it? If that's actually existing socialism, then I think that does reflect the paucity of where we're at. So yeah, it's interesting you brought up Enzo Traverso, because that's, you know, what I had in mind, particularly the European Civil War, which is a concept that Lucerda doesn't like and takes apart. And again, you know, much more interesting, rigorous, measured way of looking at these questions. One of the reasons why I think that I'm glad that I read this book, when I first read it, and this was this exploration of revisionism, that was new to me. Like, I don't read conservative thought. I don't really engage with these debates very much. And so to have a portrayal of the revisionist currents in history, I thought this is important. This is an exercise that we should be doing, because, you know, there is a tendency among anarchist history and I'm sure the histories of the left as well, to look for inspiration and to look within, you know, our own traditions and our own writings, and to talk to one another and never really kind of engage outside. And so to have a sense of what even the right is saying, or what, you know, neoliberalism, which feeds very much on this revisionist tradition, it's valuable to know what they're saying. And again, I shouldn't have been surprised, but, you know, some of the arguments, you know, coming out of the mouths of Nolte and Ferguson are incredible in a way. Perhaps I shouldn't be surprised. These people are incredibly popular and influential, but I just wasn't familiar with how extraordinary they were at times. The idea that Schmitt is being read even in conservative, this is the Nazis' leading theorist. And it brought to mind a podcast that I listened to called Know Your Enemy, which explores American conservative thought in a very sort of rigorous way. And I find that interesting precisely for that point, that idea of knowing how other people are thinking. But I would say about a third of the way in, I began to think, well, not only is it reading this book good for that, it's also good to know what other currents on the left are thinking. This is a current of leftist thinking which I cannot comprehend. And so if you said to me on paper that this have just published a book by someone who's basically an unapologetic Stalinist, I probably wouldn't believe that something would be as so clearly this, you know, in this lineage. But it is interesting to read it, because again, it gives you the ability to confront this potentially when you see it, or to, you know, to think in these terms.
That's probably a good place to end it, I think.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you found the episode interesting. We'll be back with a discussion of Maya Ramnath's Decolonizing Anarchism in a couple of weeks. Until then, you can keep in touch via our Twitter at @abcdannyandjim and our email abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra and Rafael Denuncio, Gente de Miña Tierra, reproduced from the Free Music Archive. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. The image in this episode is by Robert Hofbauer, licensed under a Creative Commons share-alike license. Details of these materials can be found in the episode notes. Love and solidarity. Until next time. We'll be right back.
Senhor Presidente,